Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I'm Willem Vanderhorst, your host for the show. I've been thinking these last couple of weeks and listening to a lot of other podcasts. Of course, I'm listening to these podcasters and the people who are doing interviews a little bit in the same vein, or at least, well, I'm imitating a little bit of what they're doing, really. They all have a catchphrase. There's generally a catchphrase to introduce the show, and I'm not sure I have one. I mean, I've been saying hello and welcome to, and I have a name for the podcast, of course, but I think that something I'll be doing the next couple of weeks is think about a catchphrase. So if ever you have an idea and you're listening to this, you have an idea for an awesome catchphrase I could be using for this podcast, I would love to hear from you. It'd be awesome. You can send me an email directly through my website on the contact page. That's at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything attached, icecreamforeveryone.net. You can also find me and post a comment on the Facebook page. Just, type in Ice Cream for Everyone. You'll find it. You can use the fantastic new range of Facebook emojis now. It's just like everything is more than alike. You can tell me if you're angry at the way I introduced the podcast, or you can tell me that you're sad, or you can tell me that you're haha, I think is another one to indicate that you're laughing, probably. You can also contact me on Twitter, of course. If you don't like Facebook, you don't use it anymore, you can contact me on Twitter. My handle is at HippoWill. Tweet at me. Tweet suggestions for a catchphrase or opening sentence to the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. If ever you're joining this in the middle and you've not heard about it, or it's the first time you're listening, in the show I interview creators and thinkers from a variety of backgrounds that I find both interesting and inspiring. Typically, it's revolving around either marketing, advertising, and media, or innovation, business. I know it's a wide topic, but I work as a marketing and brand strategist. I used to work for ad agencies, and now I have my old freelance consultancy. And I'm interested in all these different types of topics. So I'm finding and talking to people from this area. And the other thing is I have a personal passion for games. I've been a longtime tabletop role-player, depends how you're calling it. But I also love board games. I used to play a lot of video games, a little bit less now. However, I do keep in touch with what's going on in indie games because there's a lot of interesting developments around this particular area. I'm a little bit less interested in the massive, kind of like first-person shooter games, but still the amount of effort, money that goes into creating these productions is quite interesting. So I do keep in touch with that. Now, for this show, if you enjoy it, by the way, just to finish on the whole shameless promotion, you can find all the show's episodes on my website, which I've mentioned. You can also find them on iTunes, of course. You can find them on Stitcher or whatever your favorite podcast listening app device site is. It would enormously help the podcast if you listen via iTunes, or even just check and click the iTunes button that's going to be on the show notes if you're looking through my website, and give it a rating or take a few minutes to write a review. It really helps other people find the podcast. But on to today's guest. We have an exciting guest today in the world of role-playing games. We're talking to Matthew Dawkins, also known as the Gentleman Gamer. I wouldn't be able to reproduce it with his great English-British accent. But Matthew is known amongst people in role-playing games because he started a YouTube channel that's mainly focused on tabletop role-playing games. And he started that a few years ago, like 2009. He has over 14,000 subscribers and a number of videos. If you're interested in this type of game, check it out. I'll put the link in the show notes. He has stopped publishing regularly right now as of recently because he's spending more time writing at the moment. So he's writing commercially for role-playing games, which we talk about during the interview. And we talk quite a bit about Vampire the Masquerade, which is a game and a setting. Also, the setting is called The World of Darkness. It's one of the most popular commercial role-playing game settings out there. We talk about where it comes from and his interest for it and a lot of different things. And this other idea that he started, which is an idea in gaming, mixing principles from live-action role-playing games and tabletop role-playing games and mixing it up in a video conferencing format. He called that Vampire the Masquerade, the YouTube experiment in the first place. I tried it, and I tried playing and interpreting a character in this game. And a little over a year ago, Matthew and I recorded a video where both the characters we interpret, we had decided in advance that they were going to be rival enemies. So we kind of riff off and joust verbally in this video. And I'm going to put it on the show notes. So if you want to see, what is it like when I'm interpreting a role-playing game character as a vampire, because that's who he is. The character is a vampire, although we're not doing anything specific about that in the video. But yeah, so we had a fantastic conversation. It was a lot of fun. We went through loads of details, and as usual, I tried for these episodes. I mean, of course, it might be more of interest to somebody who's into role-playing games, but you're not necessarily into role-playing games. You don't have to be listening to this episode. If you're interested in storytelling, if you're interested in learning about the hobby, we make it in a way that we're explaining everything that we're talking about. So it should be accessible for just about anybody or anybody who's interested in finding out more about this type of games and why people practice them, who are the people that practice them as well. Just a word of warning, I really apologize for this, but there's a couple of fade-offs in speech inside of the video. I really don't think it's a big deal, certainly not enough to break the flow of the conversation. It's just a couple of small details, but still, I apologize for that. I'm always trying my best to give the best sound, but there's a couple of, it happens, a couple of glitches, essentially. But without further ado, for your hearing pleasure, here is the Gentleman Gamer. Enjoy.
Hi there, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you very much for joining me for the show.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Appreciate your time. So, I usually start with a warm-up question.
Okay.
So you are Matthew Dawkins, aka the Gentleman Gamer.
That's correct.
And I came across your YouTube video channel a little over a year ago and really enjoyed the videos to start with. One question I saw, you started it. It's called the Gentleman's Guide to Gaming. Sorry, but the
Yep.
URL and also your Twitter handle is Clack Click Bang.
Yes.
Was wondering if that had any particular signification.
Okay. In fact, that's a good question. I don't often get asked it. Well, it wasn't when I was first getting into role playing, but I was in an online superhero role playing game.
Okay.
And this was a role playing game set in the DC Comics universe. And it was on LiveJournal. It was called JLA Watchtower. And so the different players had different heroes and villains at their disposal. And essentially, in this role-playing game, all it really was a story crafting exercise. We would just post back and forth in character and play out interesting scenes. And one of my characters in that was a lesser-known Green Arrow villain by the name of Onomatopoeia.
Okay.
And onomatopoeia, for those who don't know, I'm sure most of you do, is a term in English, well, in Greek, I guess, for a word that sounds like it's read, if that makes sense. So, for instance, bang or plop or the like. And onomatopoeia in the comics, whenever he or she shoot someone, will the speech bubble from the character's mouth will say bang or crack, or when he places a bomb, he says boom. It's a really gimmicky villain, but the villain never speaks in anything other than onomatopoeia. So it's almost like a breaking the fourth wall kind of character, in the sense that it knows it's in a comic, and so it's speaking in comic dialogue bubbles. And so when I was starting up the YouTube channel, my character in JLA Watchtower, my predominant one was Onomatopoeia, and my handle on LiveJournal was Clack Click Bang, because that was the sound of Onomatopoeia cocking and firing a gun. And that is where the YouTube channel got its handle from.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you very much. So did that mean most of the time you were expressing yourself in onomatopoeia through the, like, when you were writing and interpreting that character?
Well, I would be able to do plenty of exposition around it. So onomatopoeia slowly opens the door and slides into the room. And as he does so, he brings a finger up to his mouth and says, shh, for instance.
Yeah, okay.
So, all of his dialogue was onomatopoeia. And I think
Brilliant.
when I was playing the character, it turned out that it was a woman behind the mask, and there were some revelations, and eventually she recovered her voice. It was all very fun stuff. I suppose these days I'd look back on it and think, well, I wrote some of that very poorly, but it was fun while we did it.
Okay, cool. So just so you know, a little bit about the podcast. So I usually interview people that I'm, well, selfishly interested in the first place, and about their creative process. And of course, role-playing games and tabletop games is one of my main hobbies, one of the reasons I'm talking to you now. But I also interview other people, and there's other kinds of people that listen to this. So just to be mindful throughout the interview that, you know, people listening might not know too much about role-playing games. So I might ask you some questions to specify or detail a few of your answers. And if we geek out too much about like game systems or things like that, it's just to be mindful and bring it back to explaining things if ever there's people that don't really know much about it.
Absolutely. We do occupy a very niche hobby.
Yeah, exactly. So let's go like a little bit about the beginning and the man behind the character. So where did you grow up?
Well, I have almost all of my life lived on the south coast of England near the south coast of England, moving between the cities of Salisbury and Southampton. Salisbury is home to Stonehenge, and a cathedral with the tallest spire in the world. That's its tourist features. I've obviously got the pamphlet with me. And Southampton is a dive. I wouldn't recommend anyone lives there. But between there, I've lived in Norwich, spent some time in London, but my heart has always remained in the south, and that is indeed where I live now.
Is it considered the West Country as well over there? Or
Not quite. Kind of central south. I think as far as the weather report goes, we're southwest, but I think geographically, where Salisbury is pretty much dead in the middle.
Yeah,
I had a very rural upbringing. I didn't actually grow up in Salisbury. I grew up outside of it in a village, 12, 15 miles away.
Okay.
And so I was very much not an urban adventurer. Uh-huh. As a young man, went to a village school, Church of England, and not that I'm a practicing churchgoer by any means, but it meant that I was raised in a certain way. I suppose you could say with certain values and certain expectations of life, but in a sense, it would have been a sheltered upbringing.
Okay. What kind of activities, interests did you get up to when you were a kid or child?
Well,
or teenager?
One thing's for certain, I definitely wasn't a sporty child. Okay. My hand-eye coordination has always been dreadful. My reflexes pretty much just as much. I put that mostly down to lack of practice than anything else. During my childhood, probably up to about the age of 11, when I went to secondary school or high school, as the Americans call it, I was very rarely on a playing field, kicking around a ball or anything like that. I was playing with action figures, He-Man, Thundercats, Ghostbusters figures, WWF wrestling figures. I was telling stories and playing them with my friends. One of the first things I did, I suppose, in the sphere of role-playing, was from about the age of 8, I was buying Choose Your Own Adventure books of the fighting fantasy genre. Not Final Fantasy, but fighting fantasy.
Yeah.
They are the sort of medieval fantasy books by Ian Livingstone and Steve Jackson, where you create your own character and go into Firetop Mountain and try and kill the warlock and face various monsters and puzzles whilst en route. I loved doing that. Despite my age, and the saleswoman in W.H. Smith, I recall her saying to my mother, "I think he's a little too young for these."
Oh, really? Were you the kind of reader of those that? Because I used to do that with a Choose Your Own Adventure. You'd like, well, at some point, feel stuck and go check just quickly, like what happens in each of the page offers.
Oh yeah, everyone cheated. I don't know anyone who didn't cheat. Exactly. It's only when I went back to them later that I started playing them seriously. But for me, it was more of a mental playground, a fantasy setting that I could then take to the playground at school, and I could say to my friends, and I always seem to be the organizer of these things, but I would say to my friends, okay, so we're in Scorpion Swamp, you are serving this character, you're serving Pashapook, you're serving I'm trying to remember the names of the characters in that novel, and these are the adventures you'll go through. And we'd create a map as we played on the playground. And I'm sure most of the other children probably looked at us and wondered what on earth we were doing. But We had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, that's great. So you like naturally fell into the role of being the leader, the game master, even before starting to play role-playing games.
Yeah, there's certainly an element of me, and I don't think this is restricted to running games, but I like to manage. I like to have control. I like to lead, and that doesn't mean I will seize power. I'm not some tyrant, but I certainly like to be the man with the plan.
Okay.
And it allows me to feel more comfortable, I suppose.
And from there, where did you study later on?
Well, I went on to secondary school at a place called Wyvern Technology College, which is still around. No real Wyverns there, sadly, where I had a fantastic history teacher and by the name of Mr. Kite, who I had always been into history from a very young age. I had a grandfather who instilled in me the value of history and would tell me stories about the English Civil War and the like with great flourish and made up facts, like Charles I was too fat to escape his window at Carisbrook Castle on the Isle of Wight and so got decapitated by the window. And for many years, that's how I thought Charles I lost his head. But in fact, that is not the case. And so I really embraced the humanities when I was at school and went on to college, Salisbury College, where I studied in my first year a diverse array of subjects, I suppose, English literature, history, archaeology, and drama and theatre studies, which I suppose if you pair them up, English literature and drama, that makes sense. Archaeology and history, that makes sense. And the second year of that, it was English literature, history, and archaeology. But from there, I never went on to university. I am not university educated. I certainly did open university, but never completed a degree because of financial reasons mostly, and time.
Did you have an idea in mind about like what kind of job or career you wanted to get into at that time?
I flitted around for a very young age. I wanted to be a professional wrestler, which, let's be honest, was never going to happen. Another point, I wanted to be a doctor. But when I was a teenager, I wanted to become a teacher of history and English literature. So I did apply to university in various places. I wanted to go to the University of Bath, and and I would have got in. However, based on my A-level results, but my college lecturer never actually sent on my UCAS form, and UCAS is the agency in the UK that deals with filtering out applications to different universities based on grades.
Okay.
And essentially, part of that procedure is you have to fill in your form indicating the universities you want to go to, the degree you want to study, and do a personal statement, like a job application.
Yeah.
And you have to give that to your college or sixth form tutor, so the tutor you have between the ages of 17 and 18.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to essentially give you a reference and then pass it on to UCAS.
Okay.
Sadly, he left his in his desk drawer over the summer.
Really?
And so while all of my friends were being accepted in universities, I was wondering, why haven't I heard anything back? I've not been accepted. I've not been declined. Some people were being declined, and I wasn't even getting that. So in the end, I called UCAS, and they said, no, we never received your application, sadly. And I got in touch with my tutor, and he very apologetically said, oh, I just found your application.
Ouch.
At that point, I could have gone through a system called clearing, where you're essentially placed in whatever university has a space.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could have carried on doing what I was doing, which was working. I had a job by that point. I was earning money. And the allure of continuing to earn money outweighed the allure of further education.
I understand. I had a quite similar experience with the university, actually. Well, not as in being rejected, but as in starting to work, earning money, and feeling it was a lot more interesting than academics, essentially.
Yeah, well, I've done well by it. It's I certainly seem to be earning a decent amount, and not having a degree has never held me back, and certainly I don't have any debt as a result. Most people, the advantage most people take away from university, or say they take away from university, is a social awareness. I suppose going straight into work, that's something I lacked and something I probably didn't gain until I was in my mid-20s. That's unfair on myself. Probably my early 20s, I remained quite sheltered and solitary, not a wide pool of friends by any means or interests.
Fair enough. And so what did you end up doing in terms of jobs, or like, did you change, or what do you do now, I guess?
Coincidentally, the job that I went into immediately after college is with the company that I work for now. Name drop them, but it's a company that deals with money, basically. It's pensions, investments, finance, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And certainly it's not what most people would call the most thrilling field in the world, but I work in training in that area. So I train employees. I handle uplifting people to certain skills, and that to me is a very rewarding job because it means I get to meet lots of people. I get to talk to lots of people.
Yeah.
And it's a nice job to feel like I am, I suppose, making people better at theirs.
Yeah. This is interesting. So do you think that playing role-playing games and practicing helped you, like, get into your role as a trainer now, or did you have any other, training to...
Absolutely. It definitely did, because when I first started, this wasn't my job, and I would say the watershed moments for me in terms of my career progression, and this isn't even including my freelance writing, which I imagine...
Which we'll talk about, of course, as well, too.
Yeah, I was probably, a few factors. One would be my wife, the primary reason, very supportive individual, who will encourage me to do absolutely anything that I want within reason. Another would be my YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And I would like to think of a third reason, because we humans like to operate in trinities, but I'll probably stick to the YouTube channel, because the channel that I set up to talk about role-playing games, I've been running games for a long time before I was on YouTube talking about them.
Actually, before we talk about YouTube, do you want to tell us, like, when you found out about role-playing games and how that started?
Yeah, sure. That was when I was at college.
Yeah.
So I was 18, I imagine, 17 or 18. And there was I was sat in the library at the college, and I was looking up NPCs from a video game you've probably heard of called Baldur's Gate.
Yes.
And I was just trying to min-max my party like any good role player would.
Just for mentioning, NPC is a non-playing character. So it's all the other people in the game that you're not playing, basically.
Yeah. So in Baldur's Gate, you create your character, whether he be a fighter, wizard, cleric, or rogue, or the like. And throughout the game, you can recruit followers for your protagonist.
Yeah.
And these followers can be of many different points of view. They could have different philosophies. They can have different abilities to use in combat. They may be spellcasters. They may be knights with swords. They could be evil. They could be good. They could be lawful. They could be chaotic. Essentially, there's a huge range. I think there's something like 20 different followers for Baldur's Gate, which is a very old game.
Yeah.
And has an amazing range considering its age. Each of the characters has a lot of depth, they have their own backstory, and so on. And so I found that kind of thing fascinating, the idea of tailoring a party, seeing how one character would interact with another. And this was before I was role-playing. And as just point of fact, I had been reading Forgotten Realms novels for probably about 10 years prior to playing Baldur's Gate. Baldur's Gate is set in a setting known as the Forgotten Realms, and the Forgotten Realms, unbeknownst to me at the time, was a setting for a Dungeons and Dragons, for Dungeons and Dragons, the sort of preeminent role-playing game.
Yeah.
And so I was looking up these non-player characters in the library on one of the PCs there, and a guy came over to me, and in creepy fashion, puts his hand on mine while it was on the mouse.
Okay.
Direct. Yeah, I know. Directed it to the search bar and typed in, may have been TSR.com or wizards.com, and illuminated me in the world of tabletop role-playing games. And he said there was a club in our town and he invited me to come along. And of okay. course, when he invited me the first time, I was reticent, shall we say. I didn't go because I thought, who is this creepy guy?
Yes.
And in fairness, he is still a creepy guy. And and a conservative councillor for Salisbury.
It's sometimes one of the issues with some of the people in our hobby, the creepiness.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it's not everybody, but
no. And I went along eventually and thought it was under the auspices of playing a game of Dungeons and Dragons. This game I'd been reading about unknowingly for a decade and playing video games set in that world unknowingly. Yeah. And maybe if I'd read the manual, I would have picked up on that. But I turned up to this club and my first role-playing game wasn't Dungeons and Dragons. That was on the other week. These games ran every other week. Mm-hmm. There were three tables. And on table three, which was the table I was assigned to, on one week they ran Dungeons and Dragons. The campaign was Ruins of Mythdranor, which is a late second edition, early third edition Dungeons and Dragons campaign. It was built to have conversion in and between systems.
Okay.
But that wasn't the game I played. Ended up playing a game of Hercules and Xena, the Legendary Journeys.
Interesting.
Which was just about the last game I would have wanted to play.
I didn't even know that was a role-playing game, but nothing surprises me in terms of setting anymore.
No, this was released, I suppose, around the time that tie-ins were constant, but it was a box set game, so a big cardboard box with various manuals, one for the player, one for the person running, a campaign module, and essentially it was high camp Greek myth.
Yeah.
And my character, if I recall, was an acrobatic thief of some variety who I very swiftly, and it's amazing looking back, because I don't think I've spoken in detail about this game, but it's strange the things you remember.
Yeah.
I remember my character, who was a female acrobatic thief who sort of played for laughs and the next big score. I ended up, it turned out, I think, I made her androgynous in the end. And I think the main reason was as a rebuttal to male role players who felt that their male characters had to hit on her because she was female. Mm. And immediately getting into the hobby, I started encountering the good, because I was role playing. It's fantastic. And it really was good fun, despite the game, which, you know, nothing actually against the game, but the setting wasn't for me. Some of the players were, shall we say, socially awkward.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was dealing with the good and the less good quite immediately. And so I suppose there was a time there where I could have said, you know what, this is all a little uncomfortable and not for me. I'll stick to my video games and novels.
Mm-hmm.
But I persevered and then played Dungeons & Dragons the week after, where I was playing a rogue again, an elven rogue, and whose name was probably something stereotypical like Tasha Nightshade. But I think she was a 15th level character. So my first ever character in Dungeons & Dragons was a ridiculously high level.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of powers to juggle, but I thought, hey, I've been playing Baldur's Gate 2 by this point, so I'm fine. Yeah. I know what I'm doing with this. I know all these powers.
Do you think there was any particular reason that captured your attention to go back another week?
I think for all I bash them, and I do it in a very lighthearted way because all of these people really are decent, you know, while they may be socially awkward at times, they all have their hearts in the right place and they're all there to play a game.
Mm.
And that is what I particularly love, the creativity, the imagination on display. When the DM, the dungeon master or GM, games master, the person running says, you walk into a room, this is what it looks like, what do you do? I know that's a very basic setup, but then you hear either the players collaborate, they talk to each other, what shall we do? Oh, well, I think I should do this, I think you should do that. Or they spontaneously start coming out with, well, I'm going to draw my sword and charge at the beholder because you're an idiot. But the point is that kind of spontaneous play, improvisational skill and imagination on display really grabbed me, even in Hercules and Xena, and it just became more pronounced in Dungeons & Dragons because that was a world I knew. Mm-hmm. So immediately I could start spouting off about the gods that I'd read about in all the novels, about magic, about NPCs, and I think in the end it probably frustrated the DM because I was saying, oh, I'd love to see this in your game, and this would be a fantastic thing to encounter. And I remember him saying to me, a guy called Simon, he said, yeah, but I'm running this game. and it was at that point I thought, this isn't entirely collaborative, but yeah, it was a hook that burrowed into me and hasn't quite let go yet.
Yeah. And so you started running games yourself, like, shortly after, or?
Yeah, didn't take me long at all. The first role-playing game I picked up, the first supplement I picked up, was actually Magic of Faerun. Faerun is the world in the Forgotten Realms, or the continent in the Forgotten Realms in which you play. And I picked that up before I picked up the Player's Handbook, Dungeon Master's Guide, and Monster Manual for Dungeons & Dragons, which are the three core books that you really need to play or run.
Yeah.
And because I was reading through Magic of Faerun, I was thinking, wow, I'd like to put this and this and this in a game, and I'd have the characters first of all starting an orc, and then fighting an orc, then they'd be fighting a troll, then they'd be fighting a mind flayer, then a beholder, and this and that. And so I wrote a very poor adventure which would see all in one forest the range of monsters from challenge rating 1 through to challenge rating 20, and hope against hope the players might survive. I suppose it was a proto Tome of Horrors.
Interesting. So like a forest fighting, street fighting style thing, one after the other.
Yeah, exactly. And I quickly became aware, okay, this isn't how it's going to work. So I think it was about 6 months after starting, I had written my first Dungeons & Dragons campaign. And it was a campaign, it wasn't just a one shot. The first thing I ran saw the players' characters going up against the Cult of the Dragon in the Dragon Coast city of Elversalt, where I commonly set my Forgotten Realms games now, probably for nostalgia reasons, and because in the novel Temple Hill, that's where that novel is set, and it really grabbed my imagination when I read it, I recall. And the Cult of the Dragon, an evil organization, of course, because they're called a cult, were kidnapping children for the purposes of sacrificing them to perform a ritual that would allow a baby dragon to grow up faster than it should, so it could literally burst from the streets of the city, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so the party of characters had to foil that, and it was a game that went surprisingly well, but did see Elversalt getting demolished by the avatar of a god who just popped up because I think the power maybe went to my head. But yeah, it was good fun.
Cool. And so onto your YouTube channel, you started that in 2009, right?
I guess it must be. You probably know better than I do.
I just checked yesterday, apparently. Yeah. Well, at least the first video remaining, because I think you had a few that were deleted because of music rights or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was late 2009.
Yeah, when I first started, I, for some reason, had this idea in my mind that people aren't going to be interested in listening to what I've got to say, so I should put music on in the background. I don't know why I had that thought. I must have been some kind of imbecile.
I noticed the music on the video. I checked out that first video, and I was going to ask you the question as well. I was like, that was interesting to have music background. But
yeah, I don't, because I'd been watching videos like that. Well, to wind back, the reason I started doing the YouTube channel was because I loved role-playing games. I'd played a whole host of role-playing games in many cities and at conventions by this point. And I realized no one was talking about them on YouTube, or rather, there were only two or three channels that were Kurt Weigel's Game Geeks, which mm-hmm. is still going, okay. Captain Machine, I met him, and he's a incredibly nice guy, but it was very amateur vlog. A guy called Tetsubo, who is still going, and that was role playing game videos intermixed with other videos on politics and yes. humanities and the like. So I just decided I'll add my voice to the choir.
Cool. Were you looking for something in particular when you were like looking for role playing game YouTube videos, or you enjoyed watching a range of different YouTube videos? Or
I was looking for reviews at first, which I think is a good gateway, and it's a good way to actually get views on your videos. It's by doing reviews, because that's the thing most people are going to stick around for. And I remember finding a review of Slay Industries, which is a role-playing game of which I'm pretty fond, by Captain Machine, and thinking, you know what, I could do a better review than this. Sorry, Captain, if you hear this. And so I built up my channel with a few videos, and another vlogger that I drew a lot of inspiration from at the start, or thought I was drawing a lot of inspiration from, was a guy who does a channel called The Spoonie Experiment, which wasn't at that point role-playing game focused, but he's a role player, and so it was very geeky. And before he disappeared up his own arse, he was an incredibly entertaining vlogger. But for some reason I thought music in the background, that will be what sets my videos apart from other people.
Interesting.
And it wasn't. In fact, it's what got most of my videos taken down, rightly so. But some of those videos are still viewable on Dailymotion. My initial reaction to YouTube removing my videos was, well, that's fine, I'll just decamp and move elsewhere. And so I did, and no one watched them. And then I thought, you know what, I'll just carry on doing the videos, but without the music, and went back to YouTube, and so it went.
Did you have anything in mind doing it a video show rather than like an audio one? Or was it simply because you were looking at videos at the time?
I think it was simply because I was looking at videos. And as a learner, and this, I suppose, goes back to my training, there's three kinds of learner. There's audible learners, visual learners, and kinesthetic learners. Mm-hmm. And kinesthetic are the strangest ones, to my mind, or at least they're the least common. They're the ones who need to learn by using things, their sense of touch.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's the sort of person that can only learn about a role-playing game by playing it rather than reading it. And then, of course, you have audible learners and visual learners, and what they are is quite apparent. And I've always been a very visual learner. And so for me, putting myself in videos and talking about games, expressing, you know, using my hands, holding up books, and letting my face do a lot of the talking was key, I think.
And one of the things I really appreciate about your videos is I would say you're really articulate, and I'd say quite eloquent as well, actually.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Do you think that's like out of any particular training or practice? Like aside, I mean, is it like down to role-playing games entirely or something else, do you think?
Which
is natural.
Well, I've certainly never gone to any kind of speech coaching. This actually goes all the way back to primary school, so way, way back. When I was a very young child, I spoke, and now that I'm going to be doing it, now that I'm going to be talking about it, I will start doing it again. I spoke incredibly slowly. I put an awful lot of pauses between my words, and I spoke very methodically. I thought intently about what I was going to say before I said it. I think part of that was due to a hope of, but I never wanted to be embarrassed. I never wanted to say the wrong thing. But most of the time it was simply because, without trying to make myself sound superb, I was a very thoughtful person. Not I was an incredibly nice person, but as a child, I needed to think about things before I did them. And this ties in again to me not being the most reflexive or coordinated person when it comes to reaction speed. That's the reason I don't drive a car. But I I always had to think about things. And so when I was young, I was constantly bullied for this because it was different. Mm. As a child, I spoke quite deeply and I spoke quite slowly. And so I trained myself, maybe actively, I'm not sure, but I know that there was on some conscious level an effort, and this was only by the time I got to about 17, mm-hmm. to start speeding up, but speak with the same clarity mm-hmm. that I always had. And if there's one thing I can say for myself, I always aim to speak with clarity. I want people to understand every single word I say, yeah. and I want to pronounce every single syllable in a word.
Yeah.
My wife sometimes mocks the fact that something in this part of the country, if someone says beetroot, uh-huh. they'll say beetroot.
Yeah.
So beetroot. I say beetroot. So most people say beetroot. If I say bottle rather than bottle, it's a very simple thing. There's lots of, it's like I might say Wednesday or or February. I say February rather than February.
Okay.
And I speak how I read. And that is why I come across as I do on my videos. That's no different to how I come across in person.
Yeah, got it.
And just my final thought on that.
Yeah.
I get an awful lot of good feedback from non-English or non-native English speakers on my channel. So from Italian, Spanish, Portuguese.
Yes.
Who say that they particularly enjoy my channel because they understand everything I'm saying.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think part of that, when I was at school, just like most people in my generation, I studied French. And there was a part of the French language, I'm not fluent in it by any means, but I like the way that they will put an object at the end of a sentence.
Yeah.
So, and it's the same with most mainland European languages. And that tends to be how I speak as well. I will never end a sentence on a preposition, and I'm about to, unless I can help it. It's always somewhere in my mind that I want people to understand what I'm saying.
Well, which is great. And given I participated in a contribute to another podcast about role-playing games in French, and I am French, I know that people in France are appreciative of that when somebody speaks quite clearly and slowly, like you do. About your video channel, so you stopped producing videos regularly a few months ago, I think, to spend more time concentrating on writing, as far as I understand.
Yep.
But before that, like, how many hours a week did you spend on your channel, approximately?
Oh, I don't know. I never kept a tally. Just the a same lot. As I never recorded when I started.
Okay.
I think the thing that probably took most of my time for my channel, and I speak about this in the past tense, and I'll get to why I'm speaking, and I'll hopefully remember to, is I hated making cuts in videos.
Right.
My idea of what a good vlog would be is someone who can speak confidently about the subject matter, who the audience is going to trust because they're speaking confidently.
Yeah.
And I found that cuts and edits don't do that. Mm. And so if I got 7 minutes into a 15-minute vlog and lost track of what I was saying, started repeating myself, or just phased out, I would stop and I would start again. So in that sense, I'm something of a perfectionist or an obsessive. I think there are very few of my vlogs where you will ever see any kind of cut, including the incredibly lengthy ones. I like to get my message out in one. And what this leads to, of course, is an awful lot of time, sometimes over an hour, spent on producing a 10-minute vlog because I want it to look pristine. As pristine as it can when it's just a guy speaking to a camera, because it's not like I've ever used special effects or anything like that.
So did you script your videos as well? Did you write them up a little bit? Or
sometimes. I've never scripted fully.
Okay.
Because this is the thing. Although the vlogging, the channel really took up a huge portion of my life, or my focus at least, it never seemed to be a big time drain.
Mm.
I never want, on one hand, I want to treat it like it was a professional endeavor. So something I wanted to take absolutely seriously. On the other hand, there was a part of me that felt this is a hobby of mine. This is something that I don't want to take seriously, because if I start taking it seriously, it will stop being fun.
Yeah.
So I've always felt that if I had to write a script word for word of what I was going to say in a video, all of a sudden, this has stopped being a channel about spontaneous thought. This has stopped being a channel about imagination. And I've now basically got a scripted show. And there are plenty of people that do have, and it works for them, and it never worked for me. So the most I ever did in the way of scripts was a couple of bullet points on a list that I would refer to before recording. And occasionally I would have that list stuck to the camera if it was a really long subject matter that I wanted to go through. Yeah. Most of the time it was for reviews that I would do that.
Okay.
But the thing that most people... I only started doing this in the last, I suppose, 2, maybe 3 years, which sounds like a long time, but I suppose since 2009 it's not. With the reviews, I started introing each of them with a piece of fiction set in the game. So I started that, I think, with Changeling the Lost, and carried on with my videos from there. And the reason I did that was because I felt telling people about systems and fiction from a removed perspective wasn't terribly enthralling. But if I start in media res, essentially, it would be more gripping for the viewer. And that material was never scripted. I always made that up on the spot or based on some random ideas I might have had floating around after reading the book.
Well,
so part of the appeal to me of doing that was it would tell me how well I had got the game.
Hmm.
Because I kind of do this for myself as well. I don't rewatch the videos, but I do want to understand a game to the degree that I can. A video on it. Anyway, that's me rambling off on a tangent for quite a long time.
No, that's fine. Really interesting. Another type of video that you had or have, I mean, and that you recorded another one as early as like yesterday night, is interviewing other game designers. And that's something that I've started doing as well. So, and you have a lot more experience than me in that. So I thought I'd ask you how you prepare for them usually. What kind of preparations you do for your interviews?
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, I'm about to contradict myself because interviews, not last night's one, to be fair, but interviews I do script to a degree. You can't really control where the guest goes, but you certainly have points that you want to refer to. And that's easier because it's a live stream. You will have a Word document up on your PC that you can refer to with various questions you want to ask. My first interview was Mark Reinhagen. And I had never intended to interview multiple game designers. I went for Mark because I had a history of making vampire-related videos.
Yeah, which is perfect because that's like the next topic I want to go into. How things work. That's brilliant.
and I started looking up Mark Reinhagen because I knew of Mark Reinhagen. He was one of the initial creators for Vampire the Masquerade and The World of Darkness. And so I was looking into him. Where had he gone? Why wasn't he involved in the game anymore? And I managed to track him down, and he was still at this point somewhat in the woods, and I'm not going to take full credit for exposing the world to Mark Reinhagen again, because he had games in the pipeline that he was intending on coming back to, but that interview was the first, as far as I know, exposure to Mark Reinhagen the world had in 6 years since he disappeared in Georgia. After leaving, after cashing in his White Wolf shares.
Mm-hmm.
And so after that, because that interview went down really well, it came as a surprise. I don't think I did a video prior to that saying, I'm going to be interviewing Mark Reinhagen. I don't recall doing it. I may have. But it came as a surprise to a lot of people, not only to see Mark Reinhagen, but also to see me interviewing Mark Reinhagen. And so I thought, well, I could make a bit of a thing of this. So I then went to Ed Greenwood. I essentially went to game designers who had an impact on me.
Yeah.
And while there are plenty of others who have had huge impacts on the hobby, I've never approached them because I want the interview to be as fun for me as it is for the viewer and hopefully for the guest.
Yeah.
And if I'm talking to someone about a game of which I know very little,
yeah,
there's a by the way, example of not using a preposition at the end of a sentence. I could have said, I can't even do it. A game I know very little of. Yeah, that doesn't sound right at all. Anyway.
No, but I have the same kind of approach. I'm starting to contact, and I have been contacting the people that, you know, I really appreciate the games of, that I have the more experience with, et cetera. Makes more sense.
Obviously, a guest is going to be more inclined to appear on a show if they have something to sell. That doesn't make them mercenary or unkind, but these people have private lives and they don't necessarily want to be in the public eye. So I was very fortunate with Mark that at the time he was developing board game by the name of Democracy.
Yes.
Sandy Peterson, I think, was just in the run-up to Cthulhu Wars, and Justin Achille was I think he was on one of the Vampire 20th anniversary products and so on. So
did you have Democracy? Do you have it? I have it.
I do. I've played it a couple of times. Sadly, it is currently in the pile of board games. It is a good game, but I don't think it's my group's game.
Yeah, it's not. I've only played it once, and I'd like to pull it out again at some point, but anyway, life is
the biggest disappointment. To take this into review territory for a sec, the biggest disappointment about Democracy, for the listeners, is a game in which you essentially all play different American political, not parties, but representatives with certain points of view. So you have protectionists, you have conservatives, you have progressives, libertarians, and the like. And you have various bills put before you. You vote on whether they pass or fail. Each of you also has a role in the court. So you have a lawmaker, you have a person in charge of fiscal spending and things like that. And it doesn't sound interesting, but it is actually quite a dynamic game with lots of cross-table bartering and politics. That's really good.
Yep.
The weakness I found, and I don't know that it's to the same degree with I Am Zombie, because we're still in very early stages of that, or I say we, Mark and team are, but my biggest issue is lack of ongoing support. I understand Democracy bit Mark quite hard, or seems to, because for one, it was delayed quite extremely, or felt like it was. There was a lot of negative backlash from the supporters because it was one of the very first Kickstarters that didn't deliver on time, sadly for Mark. And there were various promised expansions and so on that are even detailed in the manual that will never see the light of day. And I think because it left such a bad taste and probably dent in Mark's wallet. So, yeah, in fairness to him, why would he continue to pursue a project that wasn't a moneymaker? He's a businessman.
Of course.
But it means the game kind of feels incomplete. It's good for what it is, but it feels like it could have been much more.
Mm. Yeah. One other question before we move on to another topic. I was wondering because, well, I've started this show recently, and even though it's not exactly the same platform or format, did you do anything in particular to grow your subscribers or promote your video channel, or do you think there's any particular tips? Or?
One thing I stopped being asked this a while ago, probably because I was overtaken by the Dawnforged casts. Geek and Sundry, and I'm sure there are others, but my subscriber base was certainly overtaken because these are people who are more organized and treating this more as a business effort.
Yeah.
I've not been horrendous at self-promotion, but I've never really seen the need to do it.
Yeah.
And that isn't because, wow, my channel grew in a subscriber base rapidly. For the first 3 years, I was probably under 1,000 subscribers.
Mm.
my channel very much grew organically. There was no doubt a time when I had more videos than I did subscribers, and there's a lot of vloggers in a similar situation, which is an odd way to be. It's like being a writer who's released more books than he's read, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
And so my channel, I posted on the occasional forum. I didn't really engage in social media too much. Mm-hmm. I certainly didn't. I would say the biggest booms to my subscriber base, quite unintentionally, were the interviews and more likely the Vampire Masquerade Clan videos.
Which were really good, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much. A lot of people do seem to like them. And I did a similar thing for Werewolf the Apocalypse. These are both horror role-playing games, but I essentially focused on different elements of the game, did an in-depth discovery of each element, and just rattled on for 10 to 15 minutes about that element. And for some reason, the fan bases of those games just poured out in droves. I don't know whether you've checked, but I think if you look at my most popular videos on the main channel, the vampire ones are up there. They've got tens of thousands of views sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, some of them do, yeah, absolutely. Particularly your first reviews, I think, I don't know if they were the first reviews, but some of the, Vampire the Masquerade related ones anyway. It has been a very, very popular game and video game and live action. There's been a lot of other extensions, which is a good segue, because so you're an enthusiast of the World of Darkness and Vampire the Masquerade, and it's a game I haven't really talked about with anybody on my podcast just yet. So can you, and for the people listening who don't really know much about it, can you tell us a little bit more about the setting and
Of course. The World of Darkness is a setting that is essentially our world in darkness. It's our world where everything has been slightly ramped up. You're more likely to get mugged on the street. You're more likely to get knifed in a club. People are more likely to be doing drugs in the restrooms. And not only that, well, not only is crime high, corruption disgusting, and purity fast on the wane, there are also creatures of the night that dwell there that are probably fostering these attitudes, that are encouraging them, whether intentionally or not. And these creatures include vampires and werewolves and mages and wraiths and changelings. And these groups don't necessarily have sympathetic agendas towards one another, or indeed a single agenda within their own line. Vampires, for instance, are split between, at the very least, 13 clans or families or houses of vampire who all descend from a different founder. And so they each have different arrays of abilities, different cultures, different backgrounds and setups, and different agendas. So while you may have the let's say classist Ventru, who are often stereotypically seen to be occupying boardrooms and commanding corporations from on high, mm-hmm. you have the more street level Bruja and Gangrel, who are roiling for a fight, likely to take up with biker gangs, counterculture, and prey on victims within that that kind of sphere. And so it goes throughout all the World of Darkness settings. It's a really nice overlay for our current world, in the sense that, as well as being a fully fleshed setting, it's simply good fun for the Easter eggs. It's fun for being able to imagine your own home city as a World of Darkness setting. And this is what makes it an easy game to run, because you can set it in your own city and you can just tilt elements from your own city. Maybe a serial killer that was operating a few years ago was in fact a vampire. Maybe that disused building you pass on the way to work every single day is a vampire's haven, the place where he sleeps during the day. Or maybe that nightclub that you can only get in by exclusive invitation is a vampire's Elysium, where they all hang out and make their plots for the city. I find that kind of setting and inspiration incredibly evocative to my mind, and it appears from the popularity of the videos that several other people do as well.
Yeah. How did you first find out about it?
Vampire first came to me when I, okay, so a little bit of preamble, because this is a fun story, again, okay, talking about socially dysfunctional role players. First club, the place that I had played Hercules and Xena and Dungeons and Dragons, there was talk of a road trip to a place called Aldershot. Aldershot is a largely military town that doesn't have much to speak for it.
Actually, I've been there once on business. It's quite funny.
Yeah, it's not got much, but it does have a games shop.
Okay.
And that's one thing Salisbury did not have. Okay. So let's talk of a road trip to Aldershot, to go to this game shop, spend a few pounds and buy a few games.
Yeah.
And four of us wanted to go. And so I was sat in the back of a car with these three other gamers around me. And it was around the time that Attack of the Clones was due to come out.
Okay.
And I was speaking to the guy in the back with me, who is our Dungeons & Dragons GM, about a trailer that I had seen where Yoda was hopping around with a lightsaber. Spoilers. And
I think by now it should be all right.
Yeah, and I had no idea that the guy sat in front of me was a Star Wars fanatic and wanted to avoid spoilers like the plague.
Oh, right.
And all of a sudden, I saw this looming face between the two front seats as he wheeled around, reached out, grabbed me by the collar, pulled me forwards into his face, raised his other hand in a fist above my head, and said, "If you mention that film one more fucking time, pardon the language, I will smash your face in." And shortly after, and I didn't say much for the rest of the trip, to be quite honest. It was a bit startling.
I can understand that. That's a bit extreme. Go ahead.
I think as a role player, this guy has, not just as a role player, as a human being, he has certain issues. I remember him throwing a chair across the club when his character died once, so he's not necessarily what you might call adjusted. We went to this game store where I picked up Godlike, a superhero role-playing game set in the Second World War, and on the recommendation of my Dungeons and Dragons GM, Vampire the Masquerade, and he was telling me all about Vampire in the McDonald's or equivalents shortly before we went into the shop, and so I was quite amped up for it, and I saw it in there and picked it up, and yeah, it was probably the second or third role-playing game I ever bought.
Yeah.
And from that point on, a blood bond was formed to the game.
Yeah. Did you think, because this has been a very popular game, I think in part, as far as I understood and heard, it partly inspired by the Anne Rice Vampire Chronicles, but I wonder how much it influenced the later or more recent fad for vampires, you know, a la Twilight as such.
Oh, it definitely did.
Yeah.
If you ask Mark Reinhagen, he would probably tell you that more than Anne Rice, it was influenced by counterculture, about role players not feeling like they fit into the normal world. And these days, that kind of outsiderness or otherness that role players have is greatly diminished. Geek culture is in.
Yeah.
But at the time, in the 90s, that wasn't the case. And so to play punks and anarchists and bikers and the like, you're all outsiders. You're all playing people who are against the law. And so Vampire really, as you're playing a race of characters that has to exist out of normal humanity, has huge appeal to an outsider player. That means they don't really have to stretch themselves too much. But yeah, Vampire subsequently had an influence, notably to bring up one of the sort of skeletons in the closet of Vampire the Masquerade. It influenced the Underworld franchise because to the extent that White Wolf sued Sony, White Wolf were the producers for Vampire the Masquerade, and they sued Sony for Underworld because There were photos of the vampire rule books around the set of Underworld and various elements from the initial scripts, I think, and maybe even the final version. I did watch it, but I can't remember much of it. Were quite directly lifted from the World of Darkness setting.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, I've seen it a while ago as well, and it wasn't hugely memorable, but...
No, but Sony settled out of court, which tends to mean good things. Well, it meant very good things for White Wolf, because shortly after Sony did that, I believe that was when Mark Reinhagen cashed in his shares. I don't think there was a much better opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
I could well see, just the same as unknowingly, or people don't seem to recognize this, Call of Cthulhu has... You know, Cthulhu is everywhere these days.
You see extremely popular.
Cthulhu plushies, Cthulhu's hanging off of rearview mirrors in cars. There's Cthulhu toys for babies. Basically, Cthulhu is a common meme these days.
Yeah.
And yet, it's not H.P. Lovecraft that made Cthulhu a common meme. And there may be some people that disagree with this, but H.P. Lovecraft's short stories were never popular. They were never hugely popular in his life. And indeed, Cthulhu as an entity was never really described, or not accurately described, because that's part of Lovecraftiana. Yeah. The great old ones and his monsters are described in abstract ways so that you can't actually picture them with human mind. Cthulhu was first pictured in the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. And Sandy Peterson and Lynn Willis, who created that role-playing game and spawned a whole torrent of offshoots. Now we have Arkham Horror, of course, we have Cthulhu Wars, we have various and sundry Call of Cthulhu role-playing games, but we have Cthulhu media in hundreds of places. That is all down to a role-playing game that was released in the 70s. And I guarantee a lot of the people that have Cthulhu dolls don't know that. That's not me saying they're not true geeks, but it's nice to know where these things come from and what the influences are. And role-playing has a... When you think about the people that get into these industries, like making films, making media, selling plushies, a lot of these people have probably come from backgrounds where they did role-play as younger... Yeah. In their younger generations, even if they don't now.
Yeah.
And so pulling this inspiration from games that are designed to provoke imagination and creativity stretch.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Cool. So you mentioned the company White Wolf, and just... So they first published these games, and then they sold, and then there's a certain point another company took over to recreate or took over the rights to the line called Onyx Path that you write for now.
Yeah.
But then recently White Wolf came back, so I wasn't sure exactly what the organization was around that, I mean, without going into too much detail, and how you started writing with them.
That's fine. The chronology is this. White Wolf started off as a magazine publisher and got into the field of publishing tabletop role-playing games with games such as Vampire the Masquerade. They were running along quite happily. Vampire, at one point in the 90s, was the number one selling role-playing game, above Dungeons and Dragons even.
Yeah.
So you couldn't really ask for more than that. White Wolf... obviously, they started saturating media, action figures, posters, jewelry, and even swords. You could get glaives, or claves rather, for Werewolf the Apocalypse. There was an awful lot out there.
Yeah.
They even had a TV series of Vampire the Masquerade called Kindred the Embraced, which has only got one season, but it is available on Blu-ray, I think. So, anyway, White Wolf in the mid-noughties, as we call them, they were purchased by a company called CCP.
Okay.
CCP are an Icelandic company that are mostly known for releasing or creating, developing, supporting EVE Online, a MMORPG.
Right.
And EVE Online, hugely popular, and their intention, CCP's intention, was to release a World of Darkness MMO, because they saw the value of the license, and it is a valuable license.
Yeah.
And for many years, they trundled along producing this MMORPG for various reasons, they let go a lot of White Wolf employees. So the tabletop division, it wasn't as profitable as the EVE Online division, is the gist of it, as I understand it. Okay. But I can't be held to that.
No, no, sure.
And the focus on World of Darkness shifted. It got very, well, it was radically reduced.
Yeah.
To the point that ultimately Rich Thomas, one of these ex-White Wolfers, CCPers, set up his own company, Onyx Path Publishing, or rather, via CCP and White Wolf, while it was still a brand, published the Vampire the Masquerade 20th Anniversary Edition with the simple idea that it was going to be a nostalgia book. There was no intention of following it up with further books, and or indeed 20th anniversaries for the other lines. But due to its massive popularity, it instilled in Rich an idea that he would set up his own company, Onyx Path Publishing, and so he did.
Yeah.
Onyx Path Publishing purchased the license to publish these books with permission from CCP.
Okay.
Who owned the White Wolf brand.
Yeah.
White Wolf isn't defunct at this point. It's just they aren't publishing anything. No one works for White Wolf at this point in the chronology.
It's just stagnant.
Exactly. So Onyx Path are publishing all the World of Darkness lines and the various other games that White Wolf used to support. CCP very recently sold the White Wolf brand to Paradox Interactive, who are another video game publisher and developer who do the very popular Crusader Kings series, as well as Europa Universalis.
Oh, yes, I know Europa. Okay, yeah.
And they have a much greater vested interest in World of Darkness than CCP did. Essentially, the MMORPG never came to fruition with CCP. It ended up being cancelled, and that's why they sold the license.
Okay.
So Paradox bought the license, and now White Wolf as an entity exists again with two employees, and they are planning in the background a One World of Darkness line, which will probably be multimedia, and no doubt cover things like video games, tabletop role-playing games, maybe board games, and who knows, maybe even TV shows and movies. We don't know at this point. But it is an exciting time to be a fan of World of Darkness. Yeah. Onyx Path, meanwhile, continued to produce the line that was once known as New World of Darkness, or Chronicles of Darkness, a slightly different universe, and the One World of Darkness books under their 20th anniversary banners. So you can still buy books for Vampire, 20th Anniversary, Werewolf, Mage. All of these 20th anniversary lines are still supported and still being released, and the intention, as far as I know it, although I'm not an authority, is that they will continue to do so maybe up until or even by surpassing the point that White Wolf release a fourth edition of Vampire.
Okay. Do you think on the Onyx Path, and this is interesting because I had seen, but after the facts, because at that particular point I wasn't playing too much, the 20th anniversary Vampire book was massively popular. It seemed to be a good timing between the time they created Onyx Path and the rising popularity of crowdfunding platforms.
Yeah, everything gelled pretty well, but it's worth noting Vampire the Masquerade 20th Anniversary wasn't crowdfunded in the sense that we know it now. It wasn't put on Kickstarter or Indiegogo or the like. It was funded entirely from people visiting the White Wolf website.
Right.
So while a lot of people in our hobby now know that there's a 20th anniversary of Vampire the Masquerade, the deluxe versions that were released at that time, and you can buy the non-deluxe versions from DriveThruRPG, but the leather-bound edition that you could buy through White Wolf through pre-ordering wasn't as successful as the subsequent 20th anniversaries that managed to get the publicity of Kickstarter and so on.
Yeah.
Vampire 20th Anniversary is kind of, organically grown, trundled on beyond its initial funding. But yeah, in terms of the timing for all the rest of the Onyx Path projects, the birth of Kickstarter has really changed the playing field and helped them produce some really lovely looking books.
Yeah, cool. And how did you start writing for them? How did that happen?
Well, it's a controversial way, it's a way some people look leery on, and I'm going to defend myself here. Okay. So it's nothing to do with the YouTube channel. Right. Nothing to do with that. Some people have accused me of that, and I find that quite amusing, because I was doing the YouTube channel, as you say, since 2009. I certainly had no writing gigs then. I backed Book of the Worm. No, I backed Werewolf of the Apocalypse 20th Anniversary Edition. Werewolf the Apocalypse 20th Anniversary Edition was a game I was really enthusiastic for, but one of the backer levels was a level that allowed you to basically be a consulting developer on an upcoming Werewolf book.
Okay.
And I remember requesting specifically that I became that I could be a consulting developer on Book of the Worm 20th Anniversary Edition. Now, that didn't assign me any word count, but I came up with lots of ideas, and eventually I did do some writing for it. I wrote up the board of directors of Pentex, which is a multinational evil corporation in Werewolf, and a couple of thousand words. It wasn't anything great, but what I got to do was put in a first draft, get it redlined, which is essentially corrected and amended and given developer commentary by Stu Wilson, the developer of that game.
Yeah.
And then I had to write a final draft and submit that, which was approved and put into the book, and so on.
Yeah.
Now, some people look a bit sniffly at that method of entering the writing sphere because I bought my way in. But my justification for it, which I stand by, was that, for one thing, they didn't have to allow me to write anything. That wasn't what I'd paid for. And the second thing, the main reason I did that was actually to get experience of writing, to get to see how the machine worked.
Yeah.
And essentially, it was no different than paying the money for a creative writing course.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant.
I wanted to be able to essentially write something, get their developers to go over it with a fine tooth comb, tell me what I was doing wrong and right. And I was very fortunate because Stu Wilson is a very attentive developer, and will quite happily pull no punches in saying what's wrong and what's right.
Yeah.
And so he did that with my work. After that, I was bolstered with a confidence that allowed me to submit a completely separate draft of work to C.A. Suleiman, who was developing the Mummy the Curse line for Chronicles of Darkness, which is, again, the slightly separate universe to the One World of Darkness.
Yeah. And I'll add links for everything we're talking about on the show notes so that people can go and check everything out.
Okay, so I submitted some work to him, and I essentially submitted this work based on what I had learned from my limited work on Book of the Worm, and CA liked it enough to give me a 20,000-word writing gig on a book called Sothis Ascends for Mummy. Mummy is one of the World of Darkness lines, in which you play the eponymous mummies. Yeah. And I was given the task of writing 20,000 words on the era. Now I'm going to have to think back. I think it was about 551 CE, or, well, essentially around the era of the rise of Islam.
Okay.
And how that affects the world and how it affects mummies. It wasn't predominantly about the rise of Islam, but that was, I suppose, the biggest event of the time. And Justinian is the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and so on. And so I wrote a history chapter. It ties back into everything I was talking about earlier about I was incredibly inspired to write history. My first real work was writing this. I got paid for it. And I got to talk about the history of the Holy Roman Empire, the Visigoths, the burgeoning caliphates, which hadn't appeared at this point, the remnants of Rome in Britannia and Gaul and the like. And it was really good fun, and I'm still proud of the work I did on that today, because mostly because I was spending hours in the library doing research.
Yeah.
I wanted everything that I wrote for this to be as accurate but as interesting as possible. And my philosophy when writing anything, and that hasn't changed since the board of directors book of The Worm, in fact, is to provide utility to players and storytellers.
Yeah.
I want every single paragraph I write to make the reader think, oh, I could use that in a game, or yes, that would be an interesting thing to put into a game, or just to make them smile or think or be horrified. Essentially, I want to evoke a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to put words on a page just for the sake of having words there. So if I ever do systems, and yeah, I think I put some into Sophos Ascends, I want it to be a system that people will want to use, not a system that has to be used because it's there.
Yeah.
And so that's what I've done. Cool. Well, that's what I've aimed to do with everything I've written since then.
Brilliant. Did you do a lot of writing for your games beforehand?
Yeah.
I mean, usually people do, but I was wondering if you were more on the very writing or improvising.
It's changed a lot over the years. My first Dungeons and Dragons campaign, and in fact, I recapped a Pathfinder campaign. Pathfinder is a sort of derivative of Dungeons and Dragons, and better, in my opinion. I did a recap of that campaign on my channel, and for that game, I had essays of notes, encyclopedias, detailing the important characters, events, locations, and so on. And I remember the players always being quite astounded by how much I had prepared for this game. Mm. And I think that was probably the last game that I wrote in that much detail.
Mm.
Since that time, I think it was that game that really tipped me over the edge of confidence in role-playing to improvise completely, because there was a scene where they were still on a plateau. It was surrounded by towers of various different construction, a tower of bone, a tower of stone, a tower of rot, and so on. And my plan was that they would go for the tower that they could enter easily and adventure through it, loot it for whatever they had to, get their clues, and then move on to the next tower.
Uh-huh.
They went for a completely different tower.
Yes.
And they bypassed the various tricks and traps that I had planned that they would come across if they went for it. And so I had to improvise an entire dungeon.
Yes.
Every single room, every single monster, every single trap. And this was at the very start of a 3-hour session, but I did it, and it was probably one of the best sessions that I ran. The players had no idea that I was improvising, and it made me realize all these notes I'm writing now, while they are fun, they're also time consuming, and it's time I could be spending doing other things, because clearly I have been doing this long enough now that I don't need to flesh everything out on paper. I can just have it in my mind.
Yeah.
And while if I write a Dark Ages vampire game, for instance, that's predicated on traveling from one part of the world to Constantinople, for instance, I'm going to want to put brief details on paper about the locations they may come across, the vampires therein, the plots they might stumble upon. But I'm not going to be writing out dialogue, or I'm not going to be writing out set pieces, because I can describe that kind of thing.
Yes, now you have the experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, just being mindful of time, there's a couple more things I want to cover before we finish this.
Yeah, I'm okay to, I'm having fun. I'm okay, to stick around as long as you need me. I'm having fun too.
Brilliant. One thing I definitely wanted to mention, because we played in a scene together about a year ago, during that, I believe you started, but you tell me if it's not the case. Vampire the Masquerade is a game that's played around the table, as we mentioned. It's also played in live action role playing games.
Yeah.
And you've first created a kind of hybrid of the two, sort of. The YouTube experiment, Vampire the Masquerade YouTube experiment.
Yeah.
Can you explain what it is, basically?
So the Vampire the Masquerade YouTube experiment, and by all means, feel free to link to that as well, is still going. And it's still very popular. I liked the, I I was really keen to engage with the people that were watching my channel, commenting on my videos, who were all saying, I love Vampire, I love the idea of Vampire, but I never get a chance to play it, or I have no group. Yeah. And it always frustrated me in a little way to see people say that, because I thought, you're all there, you're all commenting on the same page saying I've got no group. And yet with Google Hangouts or with Skype, you can all just play together. Why not use your initiative and get in touch with each other? But, you know, such is life. So what I said was, I will set up a game, a group on Facebook, where we will all create characters. It will be essentially be a living city of Vampire the Masquerade. And if it was successful, we'd expand to Werewolf and Mage and so on. So expecting about 20 or 30 players to sign up to this, and we would be able to run various plots, simultaneous plots that will have knock-on effects to each other. The admins will be able to coordinate that kind of thing, and you would have big Elysium scenes. So that's like a vampire party where everyone turns up and gets introduced to the prince, gets involved in various other plots. Essentially, it would be like a live action role-playing game, but without having to leave the comfort of your own study or living room or bedroom or basically PC.
Yeah.
And I was amazed by the fact that I think we got something like 150 players within the first month.
Which must have been crazy to coordinate.
Yeah, it was crazy to coordinate. It was incredibly stressful to coordinate, and it was something that all of us were unprepared for. Very swiftly, people volunteered to become admins. Very swiftly, most of those admins said, you know what, this is too much. And for the first few months, I was up into the wee hours of the morning, having to message players that were disgruntled about a plot or their character, or sort out issues between players who had issues with one another, or this person's cheating, or this person's power gaming, or this person was rude to me. And, yeah, you know, that's fine. That's the job of an admin or the job of a games master. But it was a much greater undertaking than I ever anticipated. Now, that doesn't make me regret its founding. There are some people who were involved in it at that early stage who blamed it for their near divorce, blamed Vampire the Masquerade YouTube experiment for losing friends or being put off role-playing entirely, which was really unfair because there were so many people that were getting something out of it. Mm. Out of these 150 players, I would say 20 players got really upset because they weren't getting to do what they wanted to do. But
what I found fascinating in that and what you're just saying right now is years ago, I've played a lot of, well, Vampire live action role play, and the kind of situations were exactly the same. I mean, the complaints, and I have a close friend who was a storyteller and an admin for several years in one of the cities in France. And I mean, the kind of stories he told me much later about what was going on was sometimes a little bit frightening, but also a lot of fun. So
yeah, well,
a bit of
everything. That's the thing. The feedback I have got from Vampire the Masquerade YouTube experiment, and the reason it was the YouTube experiment is because every single session would be recorded, every single session would be uploaded to YouTube, so that if you ever needed to refer back to an old game and an interaction, or just watch other players having a scene, because there were some really fantastic scenes, and there still are, because, as I say, it is still going, which is testament to the fact that it works. It's just you need the right mentality to do it.
Yeah.
Everything would be there, recorded, preserved. Websites were set up around it. Various offshoots were set up. Different cliques of players set up different communities for different games. Essentially, it started a wave of this role-playing via Google Hangouts. I can't take full credit for Google Hangout role-play because I know people would have been doing it, but that kind of genre, as far as I know, it was the first. And I get a lot of feedback from people thanking me for setting it up because they finally had a chance to role-play. They've met so many new friends and been able to play characters they've always wanted to play, and because of where they live, or because they may have some social dysfunction, or they may be uncomfortable putting themselves out in a face-to-face environment, that's absolutely fine, because you can do this from your PC.
Yeah.
I think the biggest frustrations for me, because I stepped down from it, I was there for probably a year maximum.
Yeah.
And that was good enough for me. I got what I wanted out of it. I got a chance to role play. I was the prince of the city, and I had some really fun scenes. And I played other characters as well from time to time. But my greatest frustration was, and this applies to most things in role playing, was players who refused to take the initiative, which is an interesting turn of phrase, given that in role-playing game, taking initiative or rolling initiative is quite an important fact. You have to, if you want to get yourself involved in a community of role players, complaining that there are no scenes ongoing or no games ongoing is it's pissing in the wind. What you should be doing is running your own game. If there's no session local to you, look online. I guarantee there'll be a convention near you, or join a game online. And so a lot of the people that left Vampire the Masquerade YouTube experiment and its offshoots because, it was too slow. Well, you need to actually put the effort in yourself. You can't just be herded into these games and into these plots. Start these plots yourself. Be the innovator, be the imagination, and be creative. And too many people want that handed to them, which is a shame, but it just goes to show it works for some people and it doesn't work for others.
Yeah. What do you think are the main kind of, with more and more video, you know, Google Hangout, Skype, role-playing games going on, what do you think are the advantages and inconvenience of kind of doing it via video versus face-to-face around a table or in a living room?
I don't find the difference terribly pronounced. I prefer to role play in person, mostly for reactions and because when I'm role playing on video, it feels like a more orchestrated, organized affair most of the time.
Yeah.
And if you've got a big group when you're playing online, it can become more difficult than around a table to get a word in edgeways.
Yeah.
At a table, you are watching people's body language, and so you can see whether they want to talk. On Google Hangouts or Skype or Tiny Chat or what have you, you don't know, and so people try and jostle for position.
Yeah.
In a game with more than four players that you're running over Google Hangouts, it can become quite a chaotic mess. And so I would say that is the only disadvantage. I'd say the advantages vastly outweigh the disadvantages. This medium and Vampire the Masquerade YouTube experiment especially gave us the opportunity to roleplay with people from the other side of the world.
Yeah.
Just at the drop of a hat. There was no long-winded organization that you needed to put into it. You didn't have to say, well, I'll meet you this time next year in this place. All you have to do is get in front of a camera, and all of a sudden you're role-playing with someone in Japan or South Korea or Australia. For my case, you know, that would usually be a horrendous thing to try and arrange, but now you can role play with whoever you want. It also means, and this is an advantage it does have over tabletop, you can pick and choose your players, your ensemble.
Yes.
Tabletop is brilliant. I love it. I would not stop doing it if I had the choice. But you can sometimes, if you go to a formal club, end up playing with people that you don't like or you don't get on with or whose play style doesn't merge with yours online, because you have to message people in advance and say, do you want to play this or do you want to play that, or can I play in your game? You're more likely to end up with people that either you know or you know share an interest of yours. You're not just, again, herded into a game that's running just because you need to get a game in.
Yeah.
On Google Hangouts, you're playing a game because you want to play that game with these people.
Yes.
Which I think is, which helps make the hobby more amenable, more approachable to players who have specific needs.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Cool. Just to finish before, do you have any other projects on the go yourself, like or games that you're writing, or?
Yeah, well, for that you can talk about, of course. Right? Yeah. No, for World of Darkness, let's think. I have now written for several of the One World of Darkness games. So we have Werewolf, of course, with Book of the Worm. We have Wraith the Oblivion with the 20th Anniversary Edition. I've written for that.
I'm looking forward to that one.
Yep, Changeling the Dreaming 20th Anniversary Edition. I wrote for that. Wraith is a superb game. It's going to look beautiful when it comes out. I know Rich Dansky, the developer who I interviewed on my channel as well, is feverishly working away at that in between very sad personal tragedies. But he is a master at this, so I guarantee that when that book comes out, it is going to be sublime.
And
of course, I've written a handful, shall we say, of vampire books now, both for Dark Ages and Masquerade, or written for them. I've not written any entire. And for Chronicles of Darkness, I've written for Mummy the Curse, a couple of books now, and Beast the Primordial. Now, if you look me up on DriveThruRPG, what I've just said isn't going to come out in the wash. You'll type in Matthew Dawkins and you will see Book of the Worm and Sothis Ascends. Maybe even just Sothis Ascends, because I think my additional writing credit for Book of the Worm won't appear. But the other games I've written for, of which there's somewhere between 10 and 15, are all in the production schedule. And games, maybe contrary to popular opinion, take a while to release. Because there's an outline stage, there's a first draft stage, there's a red line stage, there's final draft, development, editing, art, layout, production, release. All of that can take about 2 years' time. And so I started doing this freelance writing in late 2013. So this year should probably see a lot of books with my name on coming out. I hope so, anyway, because there's a lot I've written for that I'm very proud of. One vampire release that's coming out that I'm particularly keen on is Beckett's Jihad Diary.
Okay.
Not a jihad. Well, I suppose it is a holy war. But Beckett is one of the in canon protagonists of Vampire the Masquerade. He is a Gangrel, which is a bestial clan, but he's an archaeologist and he studies the history of vampires. So throughout a number of Vampire the Masquerade books of old, you would get Beckett's interjections, or you'd get novels about him where he's saying, well, this is why the vampires are like this. A bit of a Hitchhiker's Guide.
Okay.
Interruption in a chapter, Beckett would throw in his opinion, and that would always be fun. So for Vampire the Masquerade 20th Anniversary Edition, we have written a book called Beckett's Jihad Diary. The jihad is the eternal war, eternal struggle, if you like, between various vampires, and this has been going on for millennia, that vampires of ancient age are the ones pulling the strings, pushing the chess pieces. All of your characters are pawns on a board, or puppets that are being controlled in the jihad. And in this book, which is, I think, 150,000 words long, so it's a big one, Beckett pretty much explores every single avenue of the Vampire the Masquerade corner of the World of Darkness. So if you want clan history, that's in it. Bloodline lore, that's in it. Right. What happened to this vampire, that's in it. What's going on in this city, that's in it. What are the threats of the clan founders rising and eating all of their childhood, that's in it. There's action, there's drama, there's sex, there's basically everything, and blood drinking, of course. It is a game of vampire. But it's such a complete book, and because it's written all in that first person, it's all Beckett's. It's not just Beckett writing a diary, because that would look boring. It's Beckett's diaries with transcripts of conversations. It's words scratched onto human flesh. It's tablets of stone that he's discovered. It's going to be a huge in-character book that is written like a scrapbook, like a journal, and it will look absolutely stunning.
Has that one already gone through like a crowdfunding project or?
No, it's not. I don't know whether it will be on Kickstarter. I hope it will be.
Okay.
That's entirely up to Rich.
Okay.
If it is, it will make it look even better. But due to the word count and the amount of art that's going to be needed for it because of the way we've written it, I could well see it ending up being crowdfunded. But cool. Again, that's up to Rich. Hopefully that will see the light of day or the dark of night by the end of this year. And if it does, that is a book I sincerely recommend people picking up.
Sounds great. All right. I usually finish the interviews with a few kind of cool down questions.
Okay.
And this is the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. And it's traditional to ask if you have a favorite ice cream flavor.
I do. I favor the mint choc chip ice cream flavor, although in my dotage I have started leaning towards rum and raisin.
Interesting. The mint choc chip is extremely popular. I don't know if it's I'm gonna start making some statistics the more interview you.
Well, I never understand. I think the biggest disappointment you can have eating an ice cream is thinking it's a mint choc chip and finding out it's some kind of pistachio monstrosity.
I like pistachio. Another one is, I work in marketing and advertising, and you know, given you have a lot of experience with YouTube channels, it's a quite interesting area, and I was wondering what you think, as a person who published videos on YouTube for a long time, what you think of advertising on YouTube, like pre-rolls and...
I'm absolutely comfortable with them. I've been doing them for years, and I think that the idea that some people do take exception. The common complaint is, well, this is a hobby, this is supposed to be fun, you shouldn't be putting banners on these things. Simple way to get around it is, if you don't like it, don't click on it or click off of it. It's no great shakes. I don't see why a creator should have to create things for free to be taken seriously. And if my channel has shown anything, if Geek and Sundry has shown anything, if Dawnforge Cast has shown anything, it's that advertising does not lead your channel becoming less popular.
Yeah.
Far from it. And if you can earn a few extra quid by putting adverts on your channel that you can then put into buying new role-playing games that can allow you to review new role-playing games, then excellent. Fund your own hobby with the love of your viewers.
Absolutely.
I think
I agree.
There's absolutely no harm in marketing. You're foolish if you don't do it.
Yeah. There's another thing, because I work on marketing strategy, and usually the brands or products, when they're advertising, they think of the core audience they're trying to target. And one of the areas that you might know about, or that we know about, is and also because you go to a lot of conventions, like Marvel or superhero movies, or sometimes the Sci-Fi Channel, these kinds of people are testing new ideas, showing through viral videos or comic conventions. Or do you have an idea what these kinds of companies could be doing if they targeted, or would it be worthwhile to target role-playing gamers as a group?
Well, I think it's telling that for a long time people have said that role-playing games are on the wane, which is clearly not true. It's just there's an awful lot of role-playing games out there now. You just have to attend a convention. You see that there's more people at these things now than there ever were 10 mm-hmm. years ago. Gen Con is explosive with popularity in America. So to my mind, the most obvious method of marketing to consumers for role-playing game companies is to really get in on the ground floor at these conventions, go to the new conventions as well, smaller conventions, get yourself out there. There are companies I know of that sometimes bemoan, even publicly, our product isn't selling well, so we don't think we've got the fan base. And I find myself asking, have you actually introduced yourself to the fan base?
Yeah.
You can say an awful lot for advertising online, putting banner ads on RPGNet, putting videos out there on YouTube, mm-hmm. but no YouTube channel grows overnight. my one took many years to grow to the level it has, and mine isn't massive by any means. It's big in our hobby, but it's, you know, peanuts compared to a lot of channels. So I think that kind of marketing, while necessary, should not be the marketing that's relied upon. In our hobby, which is still predominantly a hobby that's played face-to-face around a tabletop, you need to actually meet the customer. And if that means traveling to a convention or sending a representative to a convention, as an example, and it's something I will be taking up with Onyx Path, but I don't mind saying it here, I will be speaking to Rich Thomas about whether he wants me to essentially wear the Onyx Path hat at UK-based conventions, because I can get to them.
Sure.
I can promote the products, and I can increase awareness, and I don't mind doing it. I won't even ask for a fee for it. It would be my pleasure. But there's companies, I think the most telling one was at Gen Con last year, unless I was completely blind, Wizards of the Coast were not there. So Magic the Gathering was there, mostly run by volunteers, and I think some Wizards employees who... Wizards of the Coast produced Dungeons & Dragons, for anyone who doesn't know.
And Magic the Gathering.
And Magic the Gathering, which is their major cash cow, so, and that good for them. Magic is a perfectly fine game.
But that is extremely surprising they wouldn't have a presence at Gen Con. It's like
exactly, but I understand that's been the case for a couple of years. And so Paizo are there, and they produce Pathfinder. Onyx Path are there, they publish World of Darkness. Pinnacle is there, they do Savage Worlds. Chaosium are there. Basically, every role-playing company that is worthy of note, and even some that aren't, but all that want to be, are at Gen Con because it is the biggest convention for our hobby. But where was the Dungeons and Dragons stand? Where was their pomp and ceremony that heralded them as the leader our hobby? And
I wonder if it has to do with being owned by, purchased by Hasbro and cutting budgets or something.
Well, but they were published by Hasbro many, many years ago. And I think Wizards of the Coast, they often do panels and seminars at these conventions. But it just strikes me as a very strange practice. I'm sure they have perfectly good strategists telling them the reason why they should be doing this. Mm. But for me, as a customer, it puts me off. Yeah. It means, well, I'm not going to buy your product. If I can see Pelgrane Press selling 13th Age there and Paizo selling Pathfinder, those are the two biggest rivals to your fantasy banner. And Chaosium with RuneQuest.
Yeah.
And there is no Dungeons & Dragons stall selling Dungeons & Dragons products. All that tells me is you do not have faith in your own products. You will not sell them in person. You do not know how to sell them in person. Therefore, I will not buy them.
Yeah.
And maybe that's an extreme. And I will, of course, buy D&D things from time to time because it's the largest game in our hobby. Or was. But it's just a little sad. It feels like a company that is somewhat out of touch with what it needs to do to remain relevant.
Yeah, it is a little bit sad, I agree, particularly knowing that it's the most famous brand, the most famous and the oldest role-playing game. At a moment where role-playing games and geek culture is becoming more popular and more mainstream, so they could be supporting that. And if they're not present at a convention, it doesn't feel like they are.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Will Wheaton was there, well-known from both Star Trek and Geek and Sundry, and he was there to promote Titan's Grave, which is the setting for Fantasy Age, which is another fantasy, medieval fantasy-style role-playing game with sci-fi elements published by Green Ronin. And so that wheeling out that kind of star power, that's the kind of thing that draws notice. Mm. Now, I will add the caveat. Wizards of the Coast, if they were there, and I was there for the full convention, I just didn't see them. And I don't believe that they were there. So I would be interested to find out if I am, in fact, incorrect on this. Yeah.
All right, well, we'll check it and we'll see. If anybody has anything to correct, you can do that in the comments as well.
Yeah.
All right, well, Matthew, thank you so much for your time. This was a fun conversation.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Yeah, it has been a lot of fun. I'll be happy to come on again if you can think of anything else to ask.
If I have another reason or something else, I'd be happy to invite you again.
All right, lovely. All right,
thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
Well, here we go. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. It was a lot of fun recording and talking with Matthew. He's a fount of knowledge and a fount of information about role-playing games and about the settings in particular, as I'm sure you've heard. If you've enjoyed it, I repeat it, but how about sharing it with a friend? If you know a friend who's into role-playing games, if you know a friend who would enjoy this episode, send them the link via email or share it on your favorite social network. It really helps me and it helps more people discover the show. And that's essentially all I want. I mean, I just want more people to listen to this, essentially. And of course, you can also find more Ice Cream for Everyone goodies to read or to listen to on the website. That's www.icecreamforeveryone.net, all the words spelled out. I write a weekly newsletter, which I've occasionally talked about. You can find on my website called Ice Cream Sunday. No big prize for figuring out where that is published every week. And normally you get it exclusively. Well, you do get it exclusively by email. You get it first, but I've started publishing it online so more people can find it, just in case they might be interested in what's going on every week. And I'm going to be publishing it on my blog very shortly, but it's already on Medium. You can find them on medium.com, and the link is on my website as well. That's about it for now. I'll see you again next week. Until next time, game on, have fun, enjoy, and thank you for listening.